That was a tune called Bounce, the opening track from the brand new album Intermezzo by James Falzone and Katie Ernst, who are collaboratively known as Wayfaring. Welcome to Relevant Tones. I'm Stephen Anthony Rawson. Whether you're new to the show or a longtime listener, thanks so much for tuning in. Today we're joined by clarinetist, composer, improviser, and Dean of Music at Cornish College of the Arts, James Falzone. James is an acclaimed member of the international jazz and creative music scenes, a veteran contemporary music lecturer and clinician, and an award-winning composer. He and I met at Cornish's historic Carey Hall here in Seattle, where John Cage first began to experiment with the prepared piano. We had the chance to talk about James's life in music, the crooked line he's walked as an artist, bringing to balance the already and the not yet in music making, Wayfaring's new album, and a whole lot more. But before we dive in, I'd like to let you know that you can support Relevant Tones by becoming a subscriber on Patreon. For just $5 a month, you can help us continue to bring you interviews and music by some of the world's most creative musicians. Subscribers can also hear bonus footage from their favorite interviews and shows, so if you like what you hear today, please check us out and consider supporting us at patreon.com/relevanttones. Well, thanks so much for sitting down to talk with me. We get to do a whole feature on your music and your compositional and performance life, improv life. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many things that we can sit and talk about. We're also going to talk about Wayfaring mm-hmm. as a new album that just was released. Was it the 28th, 26th?
I'm forgetting the exact date, to be honest, but just about 2 weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you had a concert here in Seattle at Chapel Space was that last week?
Last Friday night,
Friday night, and then you were in Arizona on Sunday. Mm-hmm. Do you have plans to do some more performances coming up for that?
We do, actually, back in Chicago at the Hideout, one of our favorite places. That's actually one of the places that Wayfaring first performed at when we first started. We're playing there on March 14th, and then we're playing in Boston on a concert series on the 16th, and maybe another show on the East Coast. But yeah, and then this summer, right now, there's some plans to be in the UK to do some concerts.
That's cool. I imagine. So this is a duo.
Yes.
With you and Katie Ernst.
That's right.
And Katie is a bassist and vocalist, and I imagine she probably has her hands in other instruments too, just like you do. You're both multi-instrumentalists.
Actually, you know, I think those are primarily Katie's things. Bass, both acoustic and electric, and voice. At least that's what I've heard her do.
She's in Chicago.
Yes.
How did the two of you meet? You met at a... You needed a sub, right?
You know, the first time we met was when I was directing music at a church and I needed a bass player, and I had heard a lot about her and I asked her to come and play bass. And I thought, wow, what a great person and a great musician. And then there was a... she was asked to do a duo project at Constellation, which is a wonderful venue in Chicago. And it was the kind of thing where, you know, this person said, we're going to do a bunch of duos. We're choosing Katie. Choose whatever duo partner you would like. And she had known about my playing, and we knew each other a little bit from that church work. And so she called me up, and we put together just a short set of music. I think a couple of her tunes, a couple of my tunes, some improvising. And we just said, hey, that was really fun. We have a lot of connection points. And so then we booked another gig, started developing some repertoire, got asked to play at the Hyde Park Jazz Festival, and it just kind of kept growing. So I think the gigs kind of made us build repertoire. And as we built the repertoire, we kept looking for more and more things that were just interesting to us. They didn't have to be jazz or contemporary music or improvised music or whatever. They just had to be interesting to us. And so everything from old hymns fell into it, folk songs, contemporary pop songs, our own compositions, even a couple of standards, you know, things of that nature. And here we are. That would have been 2015, and our first record was released just as I was moving here. So it's called I Move, You Move, which I don't think was intentional, but it was a nice play on what was happening at that point. And then the second record came out just 2 weeks ago. And yeah, it's a joy. Katie's an incredible musician. We've got a lovely rapport together. And I think for me, it's the repertoire and the tunes. I really enjoy playing the music in the group. I mean, there's sometimes you play in a group, even my own music, I'm like, eh, whatever, it's okay. You know, I'll keep playing this tune. But the set that we do for Wayfaring, there isn't a tune I space out on. You know, I'm fully engaged the whole time, which is a lovely place to be as a performer.
There's a lot of cool things to talk about with Wayfaring. Well, a clarinet-based duo is awesome. I felt like when I went to the concert on Friday, you know, I was really amazed at the breadth of possibilities with the two instruments, and with the voice included with her singing, and you had droning, and you were doing, was it some flute work?
Penny whistle.
Oh, it was penny whistle,
yes,
right. Yeah, I was pretty amazed by all the combinations that you could come
yeah.
up with.
Well, it's true that people call us actually a trio because if you have Katie's voice, bass, and clarinet going, but it can get even more than that. If she's droning with Arco singing, I've got a drone going and I'm playing clarinet. I mean, that's just a lot of harmonic sound coming out. So it's true. We can fill up the room in ways that I think can be surprising. And we try to exploit that. We write things that move into that space and allow that kind of thing. And Katie writes beautiful tunes for voice and bass that allow me space to fit into that as well. So it's a great combination.
Yeah, it's kind of like Rush, right? You got to have all the different, as many different sounds as you can.
Oh, I like that analogy. Yeah. Who am I in there? Maybe I'm Geddy Lee.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, no, it's a joy. And I playing a bunch of concerts right in a row this past week, it just affirms the there's something special about that group that I hope we can continue. You know, it's hard being in two different cities, and but it's being a duo is much easier. You know, in terms of finances and making choices and being on the road and so forth, it's a much easier situation than I've brought as much as like six people on the road and for ensembles. That gets expensive and tiring, and lots of car rentals and things like that. So yeah,
I feel like your musical personalities blend together so well. You know, there's a track on the album. I believe it was one of the earlier ones that you performed last week. Who Put the Blood?
Yeah.
Where you're doing the circular breathing.
Yes.
Is it circular breathing?
It is indeed, yeah. Yeah, old murder ballad, probably from Ireland, maybe from England, hard to trace it back, probably 600 to 700 years old in terms of its origin. Been recorded by a lot of people. Bob Dylan has a version, you know, it goes around different versions of it, different lyrics. It's a tune that I've always loved, and it's great because I can hear something or be thinking about something, and I send Katie a track or a link, and I say, hey, what do you think about this? And the next time we get together, we just figure out how to make it work for us. We call it wayfarizing it or something. And yeah, in that situation, as you alluded to, we wanted the voice to have to be kind of presenting the lyric as a story. So I took over the bass and harmony roles, essentially, and then Katie on bass is coloring and adding textures and things, but we wanted the voice to be front and center.
I was really fascinated by the arranging possibilities, and that in particular struck me, and when you would do My Brightest Diamond song, too.
Same
kind of thing, where I was just like, you know, wow, what a cool way to reimagine this track.
And thanks for saying that. That's the whole approach, and it's not just the approach for Wayfaring. It's kind of my approach. If you're going to cover something, to me, the idea is to bring it into your own realm, to bring what you uniquely have as an artist. And certainly, anytime I've heard people cover something of my music, I don't want to hear them play like me, right? I want to hear what they would do with that tune or that composition. And that's a fun part of Wayfaring is, and we do have a lot of common reference points. We both are very involved in more freely improvised music. We both have a big jazz background. We're both involved in more contemporary music. And we both love a good pop song or a good folk song or a hymn from the Episcopal hymnal. so it's just the realm of what we can get ourselves into is kind of endless, and that's a great place to be.
Where have you been on a long summer's day? Sun, tell it unto me. fishing and a fowling in the fields and in the forest. Oh, weary mother, let me be. Weary mother, let me be. And who put the blood on your right shoulder? Son, tell it unto me. It's the blood of a hare that I killed yesterday, and I killed most manfully. I killed most manfully. The blood of a hare would never be so red. Son, tell it unto me. It's the blood of a boy that I killed yesterday, and I killed most manfully. Oh, I killed most manfully. What was between yourself and the boy? Son, tell it unto me. 'Twas mostly the cutting down of a rod that never would come to a tree, that never would come to a tree. What will you do when your daddy finds out? Son, tell it unto me. I will put my foot aboard of a ship and sail away. I will sail to a foreign country. Sail to a foreign country. What will you do with your lovely wedded wife? Son, tell it unto me. She can put her foot aboard of a ship and follow me. She can come and follow me. Come and follow me. What will you do with your two fine babes? Son, tell it unto me. I will give one to my father and the other to my mother to keep them company. Keep them company. What will you do with your house and your lands? Son, tell it unto me. I will lay them bare to the birds and the air. There's no more welcome for me. There's no more welcome for me.
you have these, they're shorter tracks on both Intermezzo and I Move, You Move that are called Tanka.
Mm-hmm.
Tanka. These are based on the Japanese literary poetic form, right?
That's exactly right, yeah. Yeah, it's basically an older version of haiku. We in the studio, we just did a lot of improvising. And then we would just find ones that we felt were compositional or that worked in some way. And then we just titled them Tanka. And it's funny because if you see the listings on them, they're not in order and they actually connect back to the first record. So we have this hope of just every time we do a record, we'll just do a few more of these and it'll be like Tanka 25, Tanka 6, Tanka, you know, and they won't have any rhyme or reason to their numbering. They're just which ones seem to work on the record at the time. What they wind up being, which we like a lot, is we would often do the improvisations to kind of clear our minds after recording one of the longer compositions. So let's just say we did Who Put the Blood, and then we're going to record something else, but we need a little bit of transition, so we'll just do some improvising. And what's interesting is that it usually sounds like the bigger thing we just recorded. So we tried to find the ones that connected nicely to the previous tracks and that are kind of foreshadowing forthcoming tracks.
That you hit on something that I thought a lot about listening to, is just how well I feel the album is curated. And it's not just this album. It's albums like Alice Musica, the Sign and the Thing Signified. And
yes.
It's just the curation of the albums, too. There's so much thought given into it where they all kind of feel like so intentional, so purposeful with
yeah.
The order.
They are. Thank you for listening and for appreciating that. You know, it's a bit of a lost art because who knows how people hear things these days.
Right.
And, you know, just this morning I noticed somebody bought three tracks from the Intermezzo album. And I thought, those are weird tracks to listen to. Like, why did you choose those three? And are you going to listen to them in order? Like, you know, because we did think about the sequencing of it and so forth. So I try to think of records very similarly to how I think of a live performance. Mm-hmm. And if you notice on a couple of the records, there are often reoccurring themes. Something that I will bring back over and over and over again. It could be in a different phase or a different arrangement, but on the record you just mentioned, there are three versions of this kind of thing called the Sign and the Thing Signified, and they keep changing each time, right,
yeah.
That they come back. I will often do that in a performance as well, where we'll return to some piece of music and maybe flip it over on its head and rearrange it, but I just like that. I feel like it gives the audience and the listener some continuity. The other day, we were doing a workshop up at Western Washington University, and a really earnest and well-meaning student said, how do you balance what you want to present with also making sure people are getting your music?
Sure.
You know, a great question for a college student to ask. And the first thing I answered, and it was kind of pithy of me, but I said, well, you're assuming I care if people listen, right? Which is a famous phrase from, I think, Milton Babbitt, you know,
yeah.
I don't care if you listen. Then there's the whole response, a group that says, I care if you listen. I actually did a little, I was interviewed by them years ago, and I really appreciate that group. And the truth is, I really do care if people listen. Like, I do care about their experience. It doesn't change the way that I make my music. I still do what I think, what I hear, what I think is, you know, appropriate and beautiful to my own ears. But I care, I want to bring them along on the journey. I recognize that some of the music I make, not all, but some of it is hard to approach, you know, and I want to bring them there. I think I owe that to them, owe it to myself. So oftentimes for me, reoccurring themes help people to say, oh, I see what we're doing. Like, oh, cool, okay, he's got me. He's telling me a story. I'm gonna keep listening because I see that he cares about me. I'm not just here and he's doing his thing and I happen to be here. He's bringing me along on a journey, on a sojourn, and that's important to me.
Yeah. I've heard similar things about, you know, audience artist relationships. I think of John Zorn, actually, someone who comes to mind, who I've heard him talk about. You know, vorticism, art is this prism, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that the artist is making an object through which a myriad of interpretations can kind of come through.
Love that, yeah. I've not heard Zorn say that, but that makes a lot of sense, and I'd like to learn more about that. Katie said something interesting in the same workshop to that student. She quoted Wynton Marsalis, who I don't often quote. I have great respect for him, but it's just not somebody I think that much about. But apparently he said... how did it go? I think I'm paraphrasing here, but the player, the performer, the composer should always be thinking about the listener, but the first listener is the composer and the performer. I'm like, that's quite brilliant, actually. Yeah. Like, so yeah, of course, think about the listener, but also put yourself in that equation and how you're manifesting what's in your inner self to the audience. And I think a lot about that. I always have. And you know, we were talking earlier about working for the church and doing church music. That's a place which is similar, I think, to film music, where it's all about the listener. Like, if you're just making music for yourself, you're not doing your job. And so working for 14 years as a church musician really got me understanding more deeply what that means to be serving people through music. And though I don't do that work any longer, I still think when I'm playing a concert, it's an act of service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it makes a huge difference for the audience too when the performers approach things that way. And the musical ways and then the non-musical ways too, of like, what I liked about Chapel Space is that how the stage is a lot lower, mm-hmm. and yeah. you're very much seeing eye to eye, and yep. there's an intimacy, a relationship that's just created through that, and it's very welcoming. It does service to the listener in that way too, I think.
It's so true, and I've done concerts there where I actually brought all the chairs for the audience on the stage, and I was doing a solo concert, and I was doing it literally, you and I are right now maybe 3 feet away. That's what we did in the solo show as well. Because I think the proximity for people is really important. And I learned that when I was an undergrad. I went to a state university in Illinois, and they brought in this wonderful lute player. Stephen Stubbs, I think was his name, who actually had a time teaching here at Cornish, I believe. But I remember we were in this fairly large hall. It was kind of like sloped seating, and the lute player was down in the bottom. And he walked in, he said, "Oh, this is not going to work. You all need to come closer." So I got down. I mean, I was 2 feet away from this guy, because the lute is such a quiet instrument. And I just remember, that's now easily 40 years ago, and I can, well, maybe 35 years ago, and I can remember everything about that concert, right? Because I was so close, it was so intimate, it was so powerful. I heard every little nuance of his fingers gliding over the strings and the plucking and so forth. And I've always wanted to do that, you know, to keep on doing that in a way. And I don't mind having smaller audiences for that kind of meaningful experience. Yes, we all want to play to large audiences, but I'll do anything I can to bring them closer.
Here's one of those short improvisations that James was talking about a few minutes ago from Intermezzo. This is Tonka number 9.
Thing Signified came up, mm-hmm. and I'm curious. That was 2007 with Ellis Music. Is that 2007?
I have no idea. it sounds about right. Yeah, sounds about right. I don't mean to sound pithy. Like I on my label, I've released 16 records now, and I do forget like what the dates are. But that sounds about right.
You probably released a few other albums that year too. It's I understand. I'm curious how that kind of came into origin, because the idea. It's referring to semiotics.
That's
could,
right.
Could look at Umberto Eco or some other people who were writing about semiotics at the time. I was reading a lot, actually, right about a couple years after your album came out, I guess, about music and semiotics was a big conversation.
Yes. Yeah.
Curious if how you got into semiotics, and maybe if that influenced the genesis of the album.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. I have to bring myself back to the 2007 James, which is a very different place for me. So I've always been interested in philosophy, semiotics, theology, kind of the relationship about just how people think about existence and, you know, how we get through this very strange life sometimes, just making sense of things. And I really appreciated the writing of Umberto Eco and others who explained that much of what we see and experience has to do with signs and the way that we read them and the way we understand them. Language, you know, the way we might process relationships has a lot to do with semiotics. And at the time I was teaching music theory and probably music history at the time as well. So it was just a kind of one of those places where my musical life, my artistic life, my teaching life, and my own reading kind of curiosity about life were all convening. And I started to realize, and I still believe, that music has very little meaning. Right? It means so much to all of us. But in and of itself, it means nothing. Like you play a note, you play an interval, you play a chord. There's nothing, there's no content there. We have to bring the sign and we have to signify it, right? So I guess I just started thinking a lot about how it freed me up at the time to just say, okay, I don't have to think about what my music means or what I have to, some kind of narrative I have to explain to the audience or the listener, which is different than what we were just talking about. So I can care about the listener, but that doesn't mean I have to try to tell them something, right? Those are two different things. And I think at that time, 2007, I was sort of freeing myself from those shackles, you know, because I think as a young artist, you're often thinking like, what does my music mean? And what am I trying to say? And I deal with that with students all the time. And I try to let them have their time to go through that. But the truth is, it doesn't mean anything. And we're sitting here in a building where John Cage first prepared pianos. And I think he taught us that as well. Like he got us recognizing that it's about sound. It's about relationships of sound. And that in and of itself is our art form. Then as human beings, we bring to it, we signify it with all kinds of meaning. So back to your great original question, that's why that record came out in that way. And when I listened to that, and sometimes when you listen to your own recordings, you think, wow, it sounds like hearing my voice when I was in my 20s, yeah, right? I would have been maybe in my early 30s at that time. And I hear a lot of experimentations in complexity that are not necessarily what I would do any longer, right? But I was trying to figure out ways to create something that felt both fluid and improvisatory, but was tightly controlled. That much of that music was pretty tightly controlled. And there was a review of it that came out, and the review, it was in Downbeat magazine, and the reviewer said, blah, 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 James Falzoni is a highly trained composer and a fine clarinetist, and there's some great, you know, some great sonorities on this record, but it all feels humorless. I was devastated by that review, but that reviewer was absolutely right. Like, I was so kind of caught up in thinking about how I could structure things to balance that back and forth between improvisation and through composed music. And I didn't quite know how to really find the sweet spot of that yet. So anyway, I'm off from your original question, but for me, improvisation and through composition, so tightly controlled composition, going back to improvisation, is a kind of semiotic relationship. I'm interested in what each of those brings to the experience of the music. One is kind of like the not yet, the unexplored, the confusing, the potentially breaking apart, which has all kinds of symbols in it, all kinds of signifying. The other is I'm, you know, clearly moving through these tightly controlled multimeter sections with, you know, repetitive motifs and so forth. I also, for that particular ensemble, that particular record, I formed a really great ensemble of people that I care about who are all now doing amazing things in their careers. But they were all really accomplished composer improvisers. So they could execute the parts, they could improvise, we could go back and forth in those kinds of ways. So I don't know, I hope that's helpful in some ways about that record. It's funny when you bring up a record like that, I have to kind of put myself back in the space of that. And I don't play any of those compositions any longer. And you know, when I hear early records like that, I've learned so much about my own music, but also about making records, about recording, about structuring a band, all kinds of things. But that's the good thing. If I heard that record and was still felt it was, you know, somehow a representation of the now, that would be a sign that I was not growing as an artist. Yeah. Long-winded answer, sorry.
Oh, I love it. I mean, I love it because I've been thinking a lot about, well, one thing that you mentioned, and you're kind of alluding to this, and I've heard you talk about, is, or read you talking about, freedom liberating form, mm-hmm. and form contextualizing freedom. I have that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like something I would say. Yes. Right.
And as an approach to... I don't want to say balancing. I don't want to say, like, you know, having a conversation with free improvisation and composition.
Yeah. I'll go back to the very first record I ever released was called The Already and the Not Yet. And I keep using that phrase because it's the best turn of phrase I have found for what I'm most interested in, which is the already, which is like a kind of sense of safety, a sense of control, and the not yet, which is that, you know, you and I are going to leave this room at some point. We have no idea what's going to happen next. We've got some plans, but there's so much of the unknown that's part of our lives. I think that's that teetering between the already and the not yet is what we experience in life. It's what we experience in existence. And I like music that teeters back and forth between those. So I've been searching for that for a long time and forming groups that do that, right? I had a longstanding jazz quartet called Clang with a bunch of Chicago musicians. And there was a bunch of tunes. I wrote a whole book of tunes, but we used those tunes as like space to improvise from. And we would go back and forth between the tunes and the improvisations. That was like a perfect vehicle. Wayfaring is another perfect vehicle. I can trust Katie to go back and forth between things. We can execute stuff on a dime. We can go off and into the not yet and come back to the already. It's the perfect place. So yes, it is. I don't mind the word balance because for me, I want to find that sweet spot where I'm, it's almost like I have my feet planted firmly on the ground and I lean into the already, which is kind of going backwards. Then I lean into the not yet and I go back and forth. But my feet are always right in that line that does it, that's on between both of those. I like being there. I'm very, very comfortable there. There are people who want more control, people who want more freedom. I'm right comfortable in that middle ground. It's kind of how I live my life, too, to be honest, you know, just in terms of... I love to cook, and I don't... You know, I love to, like, read recipes and watch cooking shows, but then just get into the kitchen and just be like, let's see what happens, you know? And I have enough control where I can make stuff happen. But there are moments when my family's eating it going, oh, this is not very good. It's like, yeah, this improvisation didn't work out too well.
Yeah, well, you know, that you're making me think of a lot of things. You know, I've heard a lot of jazz musicians talk about an element of risk,
yep.
and risk being very important in music making, but in improvisation in general. It does make it a lot more electrifying, interesting, engaging. When there's that element of leaping into the unknown from a place of feeling.
Yeah. I just happened this week, I'm teaching an improvisation course right now at Cornish. It's a required course for all of our students here. I teach it usually every spring. And these are freshmen. And so many of them either have never improvised, or if they have, it's in a very particular context, like jazz, high school jazz band, something like that. So I'm getting them to improvise with a graphic score, and it was a duet, and I could tell that they were not quite, you know, kind of taking risks. And so I try not to play too much with them. I try to let them do the playing, but in this case I said, okay, to this drummer, I said, you and me, you were going to play this duet, so let's go at it. And I was really pushing him to out on the limb, and for about 30 seconds, everybody in the room felt that energy of like, oh, what's going to happen here? Like, We're following the graphic score, but James has pushed this so far into a different realm, and the drummer was clearly at the edge of his technique. I mean, he's an 18-year-old freshman at music school, right? He's got some technique, but you could see him like, I don't know what to do. And I said, after we unpacked it, did a little postmortem, the students, there's 24 students in the class, they're like, I've never felt anything like that. It wasn't the same as other kinds of composition. Like, we didn't really know what was going to happen for a few seconds. And I was like, not only am I a great teacher, hey, all right, but because it was such a perfect moment to have happen. And I said, okay, we just accomplished, we're in week three here at Cornish, and like we just accomplished our first lesson of improvisation, which is you want to find that space as an improviser, but you don't want to be there always, because that is not really interesting for either performer or listener, but you don't want to be afraid of that space, you know, and you want to know how to control it. So that risk is super important. I think it's important for through composed music as well. Yeah. It's important for interpreters, you know, if you're a cellist who plays the Bach cello suites every once in a while, I hope you don't play them the same now as you did when you were 15 or 20 or 25. Like, it should change and you bring a different element to it. I think that's really important. You know?
We're going to take another listening break and check out James's ensemble, Clang, all caps. This is from their album, Brooklyn Lines, Chicago Spaces. This track is Brooklyn Lines. Thank you.
This is a little bit of a pivot, but I think it can be related. Something you've talked about, lineage, is you operate in, I don't know, operate in, that's not how I want to say it. You perform in a lot of different styles. You utilize a lot of different sounds. When I was at the Wayfaring concert last week, I thought, wow, there's quite a big palette here that you get to draw from. Yeah. And then listening to your records, it's even bigger than I had imagined.
Yeah.
And I've heard you talk about lineage and having a kind of a crooked line to where you've gone.
Yeah.
I'm really curious about that. I'm curious about, I don't know exactly where to begin on that line.
Yeah. The crooked line, I'm pretty sure I stole that from, who's that great singer, French-Canadian singer-songwriter connected to T-Bone Burnett? It'll come to me. There's a line of a lyric he has says that I've run a crooked line. And I remember hearing that and thinking, that resonates for me, right? Because part of it's the instrument, right? So I'm 10 years old. I tell my parents I want to play an instrument. I had seen flashcards of instruments and I thought the clarinet looked kind of cool. My good fifth grade music teacher played Peter and the Wolf for us, no kids seem to know Peter and the Wolf. It drives me crazy. But at the time, I thought, there's the cat, and that sounds really pretty, and I like the look of that instrument. It's black and shiny. And up to that point, I had been just a kind of sports kid and didn't really show much aptitude for the arts or academics. My uncle is a film composer and a very fine woodwind player. My mom's brother. So when I said I want to play the clarinet, she said, "Well, let's call Uncle Jim. I'm somewhat named after him." So the interesting thing is that he himself has had a crooked line. He's a great jazz saxophonist who also played flute in the Chicago Symphony. He's a film composer. He did a lot of jingle work. Like, he's gone all over the place. So he became my mentor, and he just took me on the crooked line in a way. It's a good name for my next record, I think, The Crooked Line, dedicated to Uncle Jim. And he's still living and active in Los Angeles. But so I remember very carefully one of the first times he came home for the holidays. We went to a vinyl record store. They exist now, but for a period there was no vinyl record stores to find. And he just bought me records. He's like, "Okay, here is Josquin Dupré. He's a Renaissance composer. You should check it out. Here's Sarah Vaughan, great jazz singer. You should check that out. Here's Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. You should listen to that. Here's Duran Duran. I really like this band." Literally, like, those were like the five or six records I got the first time I bought records with my uncle. So I'm sitting down like, "Oh, Josquin Dupré. That's cool. That sounds really interesting. I'm hearing, Shams and crumb horns or whatever." And I put on a Duran Duran record. I mean, it there was no separation between any of these things. So as I began to study music more formally, I was back and forth between more traditional clarinet technique, repertoire, learning orchestral excerpts, all the whole business, right? But then also playing jazz very seriously. And studying jazz. And then I got really interested in high school in different world music styles. And I would go, the Chicago Public Library system had so many great records. It was just kind of amazing. Yeah. And I would trace them down all over the city. I would take buses and the L to go to different libraries because there was like some, nay flute record from Syria at the record store down in Hyde Park. And so I would take the bus down there and find this record. And I just got really smitten by the sounds of world music. And then I was trying to understand like how the clarinet might sound like that. So you get these three lineages, very strong classical background, kind of straight ahead jazz, how do you play over changes, how do you play all the things you are, etc. And then trying to make the clarinet sound like the ney flute. Then I went to undergrad school with even more straight clarinet repertoire stuff. I played all the, played in orchestras, played in chamber ensembles, played the, Mozart clarinet quintet and all the stuff of the repertoire. So I really, I accomplished, I got to a level as a clarinetist where I can control the instrument. It's no longer, the clarinet is always a problem because it's a hard instrument, but I got to a level where I, I'm accomplished on the instrument where I can realize what's in my mind and my heart. And then it's just a matter of like following what's interesting to me. And that's where it was crooked. You know, it didn't take me in the paths that you would normally take. I love jazz, but I kind of fell out of love of playing straight ahead jazz. It just wasn't inspiring to me any longer. So, you know, so why do it, right? I still listen to it. I still practice tunes because it's a great way to understand things. And if somebody like wants to call a jazz tune, I'm happy to play it. But it's just not what is inspiring to me any longer, probably in my mid to late 20s. And so that was a moment when I had to say, what do I do if I'm not identifying as a jazz player? Again, there's the crook in the line. Okay, well, I'm really interested in these world music traditions. I'm going to go that route and just really explore those and try to understand what it means to play that music on my instrument without actually imitating or just appropriating, right? I wanted to appropriate in an appropriate way. So I think that's what it's always been about, is just following that inner logic. So what I will say in response to all that, to conclude that, is that what looks like a crooked line for a career or a crooked line for a pathway as an artist is not. It's my path. It's my line, right? So it's not really crooked. It's just that when you're on it, you can feel like I'm deviating from what my mentors and what people tell me I should be doing. Do I have the strength to do that and go down this other detour here and see where it leads? Again, we're back to the already and the not yet, right? People said I was crazy to not be a saxophone player. This is like 1994, 93. To not be a doubler was really not thought of as being possible. Like, if you're going to be a woodwind player, you got to play clarinet and saxophone and maybe flute as well. And then Don Byron comes along. I don't know if you know Don Byron's music. Great, great jazz clarinetist who put out a record, I'm thinking it's maybe 1993, 92, called the Tuskegee Experiments.
I've heard that.
Oh, it's a great, great record. But straight up jazz clarinet record. But not like jazz, traditional jazz. He had Bill Frisell on the record, and it's a stellar masterpiece of a record. And I'm so grateful for it, because when I heard it, it gave me a paradigm in which I could see myself. And so I immediately sold my saxophone, had a really good one, took the money, went to Europe, and backpacked around Europe for a couple of months. And it was just, it was, you know, that's, again, crooked line, maybe, but also a direct path to where I'm at right now.
Let's take another listening break and check out yet another one of James's groups. This is Alos Musica Ensemble. After James and I spoke, he was very kind to give me some CDs, and I've really enjoyed the album Nausien. This is one of my favorite tracks from that album. This is Lyal Bila Nam. Thank you.
because I'm now a dean of a college, I would say that I think we're at a wonderfully critical moment in music education where a lot of really cool people are now in places of leadership. Yeah. And I think we're really starting to see the results of changes in music education at the higher ed level. People doing some really radical things in their music programs. And I just want to like shout out and say, let's keep going. Let's keep pushing. I don't think it's over yet, you know. I think the last like 5, 6, 10 years have seen a lot of change, but we're only at the beginning. And so I just want to say as an educator that the kind of things we do as creative artists, I think we need to bring to this enterprise of training future musicians. And that means like questioning, it means being inquisitive, it means questioning the canon and overturning all the stuff that we think is so important and just throwing it up and saying, is it really that important? Letting it fall back down and say, yeah, some of that's pretty important and some of it's just not. I'm so proud of this program for having improvisation at the center and creativity at the center. We have the benefit of being an art school, so that's what we do, right? We're not training, you know, kids to go out and like be music educators in the school system. That's a whole other really important enterprise. We're training kids to go out and like play at coffee houses and play in bars and play at the chapel. And so we get this chance to like incubate what does it mean if we really help them focus on creativity from all these different angles. It's not perfect and we're still working at it. But I'm just excited by, you know, what the results. And I'm excited about what we're seeing in music education writ large. And so I guess I want to see my colleagues around the world continue to lean into that and to not... Our generation can't get complacent. You know, we can't become tenured people who just go, oh, these things that I care about so much are what's really important. Like, it has to be constantly churning, you know. So that's one thing we didn't touch on too much is the education part of it. And it's a big part of my life right now. And I see it as just an extension of my work as an artist, you know. And it's hard. And it's music. Higher education right now is in a funny place in the country. In the world, but certainly in the U.S. in terms of just the pressures on it from all kinds of ways, financial, post-pandemic, but also just the politics of higher ed is kind of, you know, completely bizarre right now to me. But I'm going to keep leaning into it and say I'm an artist as a dean leading an art school. I'm going to keep leaning into the already and the not yet and that sense of being inquisitive and pass that down to a generation of students and see what happens.
I can say I'm glad you brought up education if you're going to talk about it a little more.
Yeah.
Because I have a number of friends who work at different colleges, institutions, universities, and we talk a lot about, and a lot of what you just said resonates with some of the conversations. Things are changing a lot. And I love the direction that things are going. I felt this way when I was ending my graduate program in some ways. I felt like there was, felt the split.
Yeah.
And I felt kind of caught in the middle of it. But where things are going in education are great. And I love what places like CalArts and Cornish are doing for their students. I think it's just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate you bringing CalArts. We're sister schools. We're competitive schools, but we I have a lot of the programs are very similar in many ways, and there are others. I mean, you know, you've got other schools that are doing similar kinds of things, and even many of just your straight up university music programs are beginning to have new kinds of majors and you know, really shaking things up, which is good. And there's still plenty of old fuddy duddy programs that need to get their asses kicked, you know. Like I encounter them left and right, and they're in every genre. There's jazz programs that are super conservative and opera programs that, you know, still are killing their students. And I mean, it's I say killing metaphorically, of course, but so there's problems. I mean, I don't want to get too rosy about it, but I do feel like there's a generation that's come up that was thinking more broadly, and now they're getting into these positions where they're the ones like changing curriculum. And I feel the groundswell, I feel the tipping point, and that's really exciting to me. But complacency is a human trait, right? And so even those really interesting people who are in their 40s right now, who just got tenure and are sitting on a curriculum committee for their music program, even they can get, you know, complacent. I have to watch out too, because the things that I care about in music aren't necessarily what students care about any longer.
Right.
You know, and that's okay. And so I have to distill what I care about and say what is helpful to being a good musician in what I care about, and how can I bring that to my students? Not all the music and not all the ways of doing it, but the thing that's important. So if we take an example, I think improvisation is an important technique and skill for every musician to have. I grew up listening to the AACM and John Zorn and, you know, kind of like a free jazz context. My students have no relationship with that music, right? So the other day I played them some Albert Eiler and they were just like, what the fuck is this? You know, like they had no way to interact. I'm like, isn't this awesome? And they're all like, no, this is just absolutely crazy. So I was like, oh yeah, I think I have tried a little bit too hard. I mean, the first time I heard Albert Eiler is when I was a freshman in high school. It blew me away, but I had some context because I had been listening to Fred Anderson in Chicago and some of the great, you know, musicians from Chicago. But these students have just been listening essentially to kind of singer-songwriter alt-pop music. That's pretty much what they come out of. And so what I'm getting at is that I think educators, we have to look at what is important to us, distill out what is important for the students, and then find ways to communicate that. And that can't always be about our repertoire.
Hey, that's all for our show today. A tremendous thank you to James Falzone for joining us and all his hospitality in hosting us at Cornish's beautiful Carey Hall. We had a wonderfully broad conversation with so many additional things that couldn't quite make it into this episode, but fortunately are available to Patreon subscribers for only $5 a month. A lot of great insights into liturgical and service music, improvisation for non-musicians, and a closer look at the fascinating musical work being done at Cornish. So please consider checking us out on Patreon. Thanks so much to you, our listeners. We want to hear from you, your thoughts on the episode and the music, how you're liking Wayfaring's new album, what you've been listening to. You can drop us a line at relevanttones.com. Relevant Tones is a production of Access Contemporary Music, a nonprofit organization with the mission of providing equitable access to the transformative power of music making. Find out more at acmusic.org. For Relevant Tones, I'm Stephen Anthony Rawson. Thanks for listening and be well.